early days of Seattle, cheap lumber piled high. Buildings built on stilts escaped the floods and tide. Homes, pubs, and warehouses flourished near the shore. The wharves were filled with ships. There was plenty in the stores. In a cabinet shop on Front Street, spilled glue began to burn. Throw your coat on the flame, a worker called in turn. Before it could be done, some water first was tried. The glue exploded everywhere, the men began to cry. Fire, fire, the cry was everywhere. The bucket brigades were running around, fire everywhere. The volunteers did their best to try and stop the flames. With water pressure low, they were losing all the same. Hollowed logs for pipes brought the water very slow. The drought had dried the city and the wind began to blow. The flames spread so fast, nothing could be done. Many blocks had burned before the setting sun. It burned the shacks on Skid Road and the bubbles soon were gone. Liquor stores exploded and the mighty fire roared on. Fire, fire. Fire was everywhere.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 56, the final installment of this revisit series looking back at the content of the first episode, The Great Seattle Fire Revisited, Part 2. The morning of June 7th, 1889 dawned over a stunned and completely devastated city of Seattle. Just the day before, a massive fire had started in a cabinetry shop in the Pontius Building on the southwest corner of Front Street, which is today's First Avenue and Madison Street. The fire grew into epic proportions, and by 3 a.m. earlier that morning, the flames had finally burned themselves out. Nearly the entirety of the business district and the waterfront would be leveled, with nearly 116 acres in the heart of Seattle gone. All of its banks, stores, finance, and land companies, and hundreds of other businesses were destroyed. Seattle had been booming prior to that June 6th afternoon, and over the last couple of years leading up to the Great Seattle Fire, there were numerous elegantly built masonry buildings. Despite the recent addition of stone to the commercial district, most of the buildings in the city were built of wood with little safety or building codes in mind, and a significant amount of them dated from the early pioneer days. Masonry buildings fell just as easily to the flames as the wooden buildings did, but city leaders believed in the fireproof ability that these buildings generally offered if they weren't surrounded by hastily built and aging wooden buildings and pushed mightily for their continued construction in the immediate days after the fire ended. Despite the fact that in the very first episode of the History of the Evergreen State, I stated that Seattle was placed under martial law, it was in fact never placed under martial law, so please accept my sincerest apologies for that error. I guess I should have done more research and fact-checking before I put out that episode, but I'm glad I could finally now begin to clear that up. As the flames slowly began to subside that June 6th night, Mayor Robert Morin ended up issuing a proclamation that imposed a curfew at 8 p.m. and also closed the saloons that survived that day, and banned any further sales of alcohol to help tamp down nerves and attitudes that were maybe running a little hot that day, pun totally intended. Even though martial law hadn't been formally declared, the National Guard had been called in to help keep the peace and keep the looting to a minimum. For all of those folks that were arrested for either looting or violating the edicts of the mayor's proclamation were handled by the civic courts regardless of if they were arrested by local police or by guardsmen. It's kind of funny to note here that one of the first guys brought in for looting was reportedly wearing 4 brand new suits. June 7th saw Seattle's fiercest rivals to the south, Tacoma, send a train up to the north that was loaded with a huge party of volunteers, which also included several train cars full of blankets, food, and tents for the victims of the fire. This became the self-styled Tacoma Relief Bureau, and they ended up pitching a huge tent at the corner of 3rd Avenue and University Street, where that first night on the 7th, the tent was used by some 400 men that were made homeless by the fire of the day before. During the next day, the cots would be replaced with tables, and the volunteers handed out free food to the thankful people of Seattle, and then after the final meal of that day, the cots came back out once again to replace the tables. The next day, the Tacoma Relief Bureau set up another large tent, this time with additional sleeping space for displaced women and their children. Any thought of regional rivalry was put to the back burner, and for days afterwards, additional supplies arrived from Tacoma almost on a near-hourly basis, either by rail or by boat. Other troubling animosities faded in the face of the disaster when volunteers from the relief corps, made up mostly of members from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, fed more than 6,000 hungry and battered Seattle residents. On the 8th of June, some 10,000 people were fed at the National Guard Armory, and among the diners from both the 7th and 8th were several hundred Chinese men who were invited to return back as many times as they needed for food until they were full. Just over 3.5 years prior, in a terribly shameful episode, which I covered back in episode 3, mobs of hundreds of Seattle citizens had forcibly expelled many of the Chinese residents that were living in Seattle at the time. In the wake of the devastating fire, they would be regarded as fellow humans in need and were treated accordingly. Though firefighters with equipment from as far away as Portland, Oregon and Victoria, British Columbia arrived long after the worst was well through with, they did help the tired and almost shell-shocked volunteers of Seattle's Volunteer Fire Department put out whatever remaining hotspots there were to be found. Help in the terms of money began to be gathered from communities around the territory, and supposedly within an hour of learning about the mess up in Seattle, the good people of Tacoma raised $11,000, a huge sum of money to raise in an hour 133 years ago. Another $10,000 would be raised in that city and sent to help out. San Francisco wound up sending $20,000, Portland $10,000, and Virginia City, Nevada surprisingly sent $4,000, which was four times the amount that Olympia sent. Eventually, the total monetary contributions totaled over $120,000, which is about $3.5 million today, given inflation. Miraculously, the fire claimed no human lives, and the searing kiss of the flames never landed on residential areas to the north and east of the downtown business district, although thousands were made homeless when numerous boarding houses, brothels, and other living spaces fell to the flames. There would be no period of mourning for what the city lost, for in the eyes of the movers and shakers who had lost the most but could bear the loss the easiest, the fire was a chance to start fresh and rebuild itself to be a grand seaport instead of a muddy frontier slum. One could even say that before the ashes of the Great Seattle Fire had even fully cooled, the remarkable process of rebuilding Seattle had fully commenced. Just an hour after the Great Seattle Fire was considered to be done, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer distributed its first post-fire edition, which was distributed beginning at 4 a.m. that June 7th morning. In it, they published a call by Mayor Robert Morin for a public meeting to be held that morning at 11 a.m. to consider ways and means and necessity of the hour. The meeting would be held at the 1st Regiment Armory that was located on Union Street and was a huge and ornate structure that was well outside of the fire's path of destruction. In a rather remarkable turn of events, the Post-Intelligencer lost its offices and the entirety of its presses. The PI was able to print a 2-page paper at a home located on 4th Avenue and Columbia Street. The June 8th edition carried a detailed account of the citizens' meeting under the cheerful headline, Full of Hope. More than 600 people attended the meeting at the 1st Regimental Armory, but instead of being a sad and somber affair, it was rather joyous and everyone was in a nearly festive mood, with the PI writing in their June 8th edition, "Not a single long face was seen. No one not familiar with the facts would have imagined that the assembly, as individuals, was in the midst of a calamity. The air of cheerful earnestness was surprising. Should Seattle permit the erection of wooden buildings within the fire limits going forward? And should several vital and continually clogged streets in the burned-out district be widened and straightened?" boomed Mayor Robert Morin as he gaveled the meeting to order promptly at 11 a.m. that morning. The Honorable John P. Hoyt, who had served on the Washington Territorial Supreme Court and would go on to serve on the Supreme Court of Washington State, at the time of the fire, he managed Washington Territory's largest bank and spoke after Robert Morin, telling the gathered men, "In the work of rebuilding Seattle, the banks may be depended upon to aid with all their power," and with this statement, the judge was greeted by three cheers for the bankers of Seattle. Next up to speak to the gathered mass was lawyer and real estate developer G. Morris Haller, who was greeted with another loud cheer when he stated that he was vehemently opposed to the construction of any wooden buildings in the burned-out area and also proposed, to even more cheers, that Front Street should be widened by at least 24 feet, with property owners on both west and east sides giving 12 feet of their land to the cause. Haller finally went on to say, "We want to put Front Street right through." He was again met with cheers from the crowd as he took his seat. It's interesting but also sad to note here that Mr. Haller would never live to see the full recovery of his city because, before the end of 1889, he drowned along with two other companions while on a duck hunting trip near Whidbey Island. Mr. Haller, I might also note, is unrelated to Granville O. Haller, the father of Theodore N. Haller, of which Seattle's Haller Lake is named. The small comment that Mr. Haller made about putting Front Street right through was in reference to a problem dating back to the earliest days of Seattle after moving from New York Elkey, and yes, that's how Elkhi would have been pronounced back then. When Seattle pioneers Carson Boren, Arthur Denny, and David Doc Maynard recorded Seattle's first ever plats, the only substantial road in what was then really only just a small settlement was called Mill Street, later known as Yesler Avenue and known today as Yesler Way, which ran east to west and divided Seattle's oldest and more flat section from the area to the north. Doc Maynard believed that streets in his plat that was south of Mill Street should follow the cardinal compass points, and so platted the north-south streets accordingly. For those of you that have ever driven in the area around Yesler Way can attest that this belief of Maynard's was a terrible and foolish way to go about making streets, and is still a problem in Seattle some 170 years later. Things that make you go, hmm. Denny and Bourne stuck to the way that made the most sense and paralleled the shore of Elliott Bay when they platted their north-south streets, which intersected Mill Street at a more shallow angle. You'd think that Front Street would be able to carry right through to Commercial Street, but it was blocked by the massive Yesler-Leary building, also known as the Yesler Block. This block would be lost to the flames of the Great Seattle Fire, though, but the land the building had sat on was still owned by the mostly grumpy Henry Yesler, who was not about to give up any damn good land without a good fight, but I'll talk about that a little later in the show. The next speaker at the meeting on the 7th of June was the founder of Puget Sound National Bank, Jacob Firth, who rose and told the waiting crowd, "The time is not far distant when we will look upon yesterday's fire as an actual benefit to Seattle." Like many gathered that day at the meeting, Mr. Firth was strongly against any wooden buildings being allowed in the fire zone. Following Judge Hoyt's tack, he ended with great applause when he said, "The banks will do everything in their power to assist the business community of Seattle." The next speaker was a gentleman who would probably star in his own episode at some point and was former Washington territorial governor who, in just a few months after the Great Seattle Fire, would become the first governor of the newly created state of Washington, Elisha P. Ferry. Elisha P. Ferry took a slightly different approach than Mr. Firth when he argued that displaced businesses should be allowed to build temporary buildings in the burned-out zone with the understanding that the temporary structures be torn down within a year. This statement was met with absolute silence, with not even a cough or a sigh being heard. Mr. Ferry did receive strong applause when he said, according to the Post-Intelligencer, "Those who wish to build with bricks can get funds of the banks here, and when they run low, we can get all the money we want in San Francisco." Even more applause was met when he finished by saying that Seattle would not go begging for money, but it would freely accept any aid that was offered. Every other speaker seemed to agree with Mr. Firth, Mr. Haller, and the others who were demanding that any new buildings that were soon to be constructed in the burned-out area should not be built of wood but of brick and stone. An important aspect to the Seattle that we know today and overpay to experience is the Seattle Underground, which was created as a direct result of the near-unanimous agreement in this meeting to raise several streets to improve the drainage of the sewer. At the time, the sewer drained right into the waters of Elliott Bay and frequently and disgustingly backed up during high tides. Also agreed upon was that some streets north of Yesler Avenue should be joined seamlessly with those to its south in the old Doc Maynard platted part of town, as well as naming several streets that should be widened in addition to being raised. The Chief Justice of the Territorial Supreme Court, Cornelius Holgate Hanford, ended up standing atop a chair at the edge of the meeting and shouted that a committee of five should be appointed to plan a total replat of the burned-out commercial district to achieve the goals that were being brainstormed at the meeting. This motion would be seconded by what the PI reported as hundreds of voices that were carried with a large shout. Nearing the end of the meeting, Mr. Haller raised a formal motion to ban any wooden buildings from the burned-out zone. A massive chorus of "Ayes" echoed throughout the 1st Regimental Armory, followed by even louder cheers after Mayor Morin announced that the motion had been carried unanimously. Showing a huge level of optimism and a growing confidence in their resiliency, the people gathered at the meeting shouted down a proposition made by former territorial governor Watson C. Squire suggesting that money that was intended for Johnstown, Pennsylvania, to help with the flood recovery from the disastrous inundation of the town 6 days before the Great Fire that was caused by a burst dam. The Seattle Board of Trade had raised more than $500 to aid the victims of that terrible flooding tragedy. Shouts of "Send it! Send it away! We don't want the damn money!" The money went to where it was originally intended, showing that the good people of Seattle were always willing to help others out even if they were in desperate need of help themselves. More meetings followed the one on the morning of the 7th, including one later that evening that included the full Seattle City Council and found them all agreeing wholeheartedly with the sentiments expressed at the earlier meeting. With the area along the waterfront being the sole exception, no wooden buildings were allowed to be constructed in the fire zone, with tents serving the temporary needs of burned-out businesses, and several streets would be widened extensively, straightened out, and significantly raised. During the remainder of the summer of 1889, the Seattle City Council ended up passing dozens of ordinances to meet the goals of that first meeting. Within just 2 days of the fire, a few of the businesses had wound up in an undamaged group of buildings that were located along the east side of 2nd Street that was north of Columbia. On the west side between 2nd and Front Streets, and continuing on for numerous blocks on either side, was a veritable sea of more than 100 canvas tents that housed all sorts of businesses. One contemporary historian, Frederick James Grant, wrote in his 1891 book, History of Seattle, Washington, "Within 5 days, snowy lines of canvas began to cover the blackened blocks, and before a fortnight, business was crowding the streets as before. During the remainder of the summer and through the autumn and winter, business was thus housed. The National Guardsmen had been on patrol on shifts with very little sleep for over 96 hours by the time they were released from duty on the 11th of June, but they would be brought back within days after an uncontrollable mob combed through some of the wreckage looking for any valuables that were to be found. June 12th saw Mayor Robert Morin hire nearly 500 men to start the arduous task of clearing the debris and salvaging any and all bricks from destroyed buildings that could be salvaged and used in the rebuilding process. The mayor and city council, instead of choosing to remove the rubble, which would have been even harder work and way more time-consuming, decided that streets and new buildings would just be built atop the charred ruins. What building remnants and bricks that could not be salvaged were either leveled or used to fill in the basements of burned-out buildings. Published in the Great Seattle Fire of June 6, 1889, by C.W. Austin and H.S. Scott just several months after the conflagration, the new Seattle will be a much better city than the old. It will be constructed of brick and stone. It will have broad business thoroughfares, unexcelled dockage, and wharfage facilities. The old city of pioneer days lies buried beneath 115 acres of ash, but already out of this grave a young phoenix is rising, glorious in its beauty and endowed with strength and energy. Just 4 days after the fire, the committee that was appointed by Mayor Morin, which included Haller, Hanford, and Hoyt, issued its proposal for replatting much of the downtown area. A few of the recommendations that this committee made included the widening of Front and Commercial Street to 84 feet by cutting 9 feet off of adjoining properties on either sides of both streets. Cantankerous old man Yesler had his Yesler's Corner cut off to allow those two streets to finally meet up for the first time. The widening of 2nd Street, South 2nd Street, and South 3rd Street all to be 90 feet by cutting off 12 feet from each adjoining property along both sides of each respective street. And Yesler Avenue would be widened from 66 to 90 feet. A system would be established by the city council that would compensate each property owner for their land losses for the widening of streets, but the good people of Seattle still had to know exactly what they would be allowed to build in the burned-out zone. This issue would be corrected just 3 weeks later on the 1st of July when the Seattle City Council passed Ordinance 1147, which was the first ever comprehensive set of building codes enacted in the city of Seattle, with many more following over the years to come. Ordinance 1147 comprised 33 sections laid out over 61 typescript pages. It started off with the most basic of rules. Section 1 of Ordinance 1147 reads as follows. All buildings hereafter erected within the fire limits of the city of Seattle shall be made and constructed of brick or stone. This code also required that every building in the fire zone would be built with firewalls between them, also set standards for privies and water closets, standardized how foundations could be constructed, and set quite lengthy standards in Section 9 of the ordinance that I won't get to here for every theater, opera house, concert hall, or building to be used for public entertainment. Just 8 days after the building codes were announced by the council, Mayor Robert Morin signed the ordinance that created the first office of superintendent of buildings in Seattle, intended to enforce compliance with the codes of Ordinance 1147. Financial sources in East Coast cities and in San Francisco issued the condition that any future investments into Seattle would only happen if the city banned wooden buildings in the burned-out zone, which 1147 started off with in its first section. This had an immediate and beneficial effect on the city in the infancy of its rebirth. Most businesses in Seattle that were planning on rebuilding chose to do so on the land that they already owned, so when a proposal was made to move the business district of Seattle to the flatter ground south of Yesler, it was flat out rejected without much debate at all. Many knew that the streets would be widened, but that wouldn't come until later, so businessmen and workers were not prepared to wait that long and just wanted to get to work as fast as they could. There was one problem with their eagerness, however, and that was the fact that most of the wharves and docks along the waterfront were destroyed and the railroad depots as well, which meant it was a monumental task to get the much-needed massive amounts of building supplies into the city. Estimates said that nearly 3/4 of the bricks from the destroyed buildings could be reused in new construction, and although there were well over a dozen brickyards in the greater Seattle area at the time, the problem of getting their product to the construction zones in the burned-out district reared its ugly head again. Due to the overwhelmingly glaring problem of logistics, or the lack thereof, most of the initial work of rebuilding went into the waterfront portion of the burned area, and despite the ban on wooden buildings, this was of course the age before steel, lumber was still vital in the framing of the new masonry buildings and was always in an abundance. During the first 3 weeks of the rebuilding process, over 6 million board feet of milled lumber would be ordered. Seattle luckily still had a few small mills that were outside of the burned district to help keep up with the rising demand for lumber, and the much larger mills of Port Gamble, Port Madison, and Port Blakely soon began to bring in vast amounts of lumber to the city. Newspaper accounts are really the only detailed contemporaneous accounts of how the work progressed, but the speed and superb workmanship that was shown during the process was highly commented on and praised. Over 400 new buildings had been erected and were open for business within that first year, with the dominating architectural style for these new buildings being Romanesque Revival, which, if I've got to be honest here, has got to be one of my favorite styles of architecture, and if I ever win it big with the lottery, I want to build a home in the style with lots of dark brick and parapets, of course. The Pacific Coast Architectural Database simply credits Elmer H. Fisher with designing over a dozen structures in the 12 months following the fire, while another source places that estimate at nearly 50, so it's reasonable to assume the actual number is somewhere within those two estimates. Elmer Fisher was born in Scotland around 1840, with very little of his life before the age of 40 being known. He spent considerable time in Minneapolis, Denver, and Butte, Montana before he wound up practicing architecture in Victoria, British Columbia in 1886. His buildings can still be found in numerous cities across Canada. He moved to Port Townsend and ended up designing one of my favorite buildings there in the Victorian seaport, the McCurdy Block, in 1887. He went on to design several other commercial blocks, and the same year he designed the McCurdy Block, he opened an office in Seattle and designed about 8 buildings that were lost to the destruction of the fire that June 6th day. A few of his notable building designs in the Romanesque and Classical Revival styles in the business district included the Burke Building that occupied the corner of 2nd Avenue and Marion Street, which was a 6-story structure with retail spaces on the ground floor and office spaces taking up the remaining levels. Another was the Pioneer Building for Henry Yesler and was similar to the Burke in that they were both 6 stories with very similar facades with 5 rounded bays and a rounded corner bay, with the Burke and Pioneer buildings both having a central bay that rose above the parapet lines within which contained a main entryway trimmed in rusticated stone. While Henry Yesler's beautifully designed Pioneer Building still stands today and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, unfortunately the Burke Building would be demolished in 1971, though its entryway arch from the facade would be preserved in front of the Henry M. Jackson Federal Building that replaced it. That cantankerous old man I mentioned earlier by the name of Henry Yesler was already well into old age when he first arrived in Seattle in 1852, and though was known as a generous benefactor, he also had a reputation of a litigious and grumpy man. He wasn't all that good of a businessman, but due to him having extensive property holdings of what became downtown Seattle, it eventually made him one of the wealthiest people in all of the city, so he had clout and had actually been elected mayor of Seattle twice before. He became irate when the post-fire replatting committee suggested that part of his corner be taken for the connection of Front and Commercial Street. Now keep in mind here that Mr. Yesler was nearing the ripe old age of 80, and following the recommendations of the committee being released, he angrily revoked $1 million bequeathment to the city, complaining extensively that there was no amount of money that would make up for the lost income he could have made had he been able to construct the buildings there that he intended. Instead of the 84 feet that was needed, he offered the city just a paltry 9 feet. Bill Spiedel says in his Sons of the Prophets that Yesler warned the council, "Accept this or be involved in litigation with me as long as I live." The Seattle City Council would meet in regard to the issue of Yesler's Corner on the 26th of June, 1889, just 20 days after the fire. This meeting of the council would actually end up being a member short since one of the eight had just had a heart attack earlier that very day. The council, regardless of seated members, needed 7 votes, which meant that the vote had to be unanimous. It would not be, with one F.J. Burns voting against the seizure of the old pioneer's property. It seemed that the cantankerous pioneer had gotten his way and the two heavily trafficked streets even in those days would not connect. The decision was hated by the press and most residents of the city, and rather quickly all of the council members came to the realization that their political futures were beginning to face some serious jeopardy. This led to the council meeting on the 30th of June, just 4 days later, where Ordinance 1143 would be passed, entitled, "An Ordinance to Lay Off and Establish a Public Square in the City of Seattle." This resulted in a portion of Yesler's Corner being condemned for the express purpose, with front and commercial streets finally connecting and alleviating traffic in that area for the most part. Another important and recognizable feature of the city that we enjoy today would be curated from Yesler's Corner, and that is Pioneer Square. It seemed impossible for old man Yesler to let the issue go, and so he sued the city for compensation and would be awarded $156,000 for the nearly 13,000 square feet that was condemned, which ended up being about $12 a square foot. Another source claims that Yesler was actually only awarded $125,000, or less than $10 a square foot. It's important to note here that Yesler was an exception and not the rule when it came to the compensation of the taken land for the street widenings. All the other property owners combined surrendered about 250,000 square feet and only ended up receiving less than 60 cents per square foot, with total payouts to all parties equaling nearly $144,000. Insurance investigators in the weeks after the Great Fire charged Seattle with having an inadequate water supply and an inadequate fire department. The volunteer firefighters were described as being poorly trained, with most of them quitting in disgust at the charges. Chief Collins was among the men who resigned. In response to this, the city ended up authorizing the creation of a fully professional and paid fire department. That was passed by ordinance on the 17th of October, just 4 months after the events of June 6th. 3 days later, Gardner Kellogg was selected as chief, and 32 men would be hired. Since the old firehouses were destroyed in the fire, the new fire department was housed in temporary structures that had very leaky canvas roofs. During the winter, many men and horses fell ill due to these leaks, until the first new station was opened the following summer. To solve the other issue that the insurance investigators raised, Seattle curated its first publicly owned utility company. Remember, when the fire hit, the city was relying on water from the Spring Hill Water Company, which got its water from Lake Washington and natural springs on First Hill that proved to be terribly inadequate. The water was held in 2 massive wooden reservoirs on First Hill and on Beacon Hill. From there, it would be gravity-fed to Seattle's downtown and mains that were way too small and most of the time made of hollowed-out logs, which were proved to be equally susceptible to the flames, causing their total failure. Just a month after the fire, in early July, the men of Seattle were asked to vote on Ordinance Number 1125, which asked whether or not the city of Seattle shall erect and maintain waterworks at a cost not to exceed $1 million. The ordinance was approved by a huge margin, with 1,875 for and only 51 votes against. The next year, in 1890, the city purchased the Spring Hill Water Company and another private water supplier. Larger and more modern water mains would be put in place as the city began to rebuild itself, and eventually the city tapped the Cedar River to ensure a proper and reliable water source for the city for years to come afterward. I couldn't wrap up an episode specifically about the Great Seattle Fire without talking a little about where most of us have learned a lot about it, and that's the Seattle Underground. The city passed those extensive ordinances establishing the first building codes in Seattle, and among them included which streets would be raised and by how much. This would be accomplished by the building of thick retaining walls made of either stone or timber or both along either side of the street where they would meet the curb, then filling the space between. Often, heavy timbered roadways would be placed atop the fill. Many of the buildings that were built following the fire were constructed before the streets were raised, so their first and sometimes even second level were now below street level. Their large and ornate storefront windows and main entrances were now staring into the darkness at the street's retaining walls. There were ladders or stairs that led down to these dark storefronts for a while at first, but then new sidewalks were added and it further limited light and access for the businesses that were still operating below street level. The now completely underground levels were no longer easily accessible, and over a short amount of time, they would be abandoned for businesses out of the dark and dank underground. The abandonment of the underground led to a dystopian, literal underground of prostitution, opium dens, and other illicit activities, which led to the city finally sealing off all access points during a typhoid scare in 1907. Though parts of it would begin to be reopened by the early 1960s for commercial underground tours. If you'd like to learn more about the history of, like, the Seattle Underground and Bill Spiedel and how that all got started, I suggest you go check out their website. It's got a ton of interesting information and is a good little read. Let's end this episode with some words written by author Welford Beaton in his 1914 book, The City That Made Itself. The frontiersmen had had another challenge. Fate lit a torch which called to arms the enterprise and spirit of the people, and while the ashes were still warm, the task of building the city again began. The men upon whom the city relied, who had fought their battles in the past, again rose to the emergency and proved equal to the task. Before I end today's episode, I have a couple of shout-outs I'd like to make. First up is for Donna, who left a great 5-star review over on iTunes. She wrote, "I love this podcast. I am learning so much, and he is making it interesting. The topics are wonderfully varied as well. Thank you for the words of encouragement and for helping the show to grow." My last shout-out also goes to Donna, and is about something I haven't really mentioned on the show for a while, and that's my Buy Me a Coffee profile, which offers you, the listener, the chance to help out the show. It's kind of like Patreon, but honestly, I like the name better, so I went with that. The podcast got its first monthly supporter on there, so that money is going back into the show to help me pay for the hosting platform I use. I've been kicking around an idea that would see a new exclusive episode released for supporters only, maybe even 2 extra a week, depending on how the support goes. The plan would be to use some of the shorter episodes I have on the back burner and maybe call them something like Evergreen Tidbits. My plan with that is to roll it out after getting to 4 or 5 monthly supporters. Long story short, thank you again to Donna for her monthly contribution. It is greatly appreciated and has provided me with a lot of motivation.
Thank you for listening to this conclusion to the 4-part revisit of Episode 1, The Washington Firestorm of 1889. I hope you enjoyed these episodes as much as I did revisiting them and significantly expanding upon what I originally started back in December of 2020. Next week, we'll start a look at the long and interesting story of the City of Dreams, Port Townsend, which will be broken up into 2 parts. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. It really does help the show to grow and expand its audience, and any help that you can give would be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the Pacific Coast Architectural Database, Glenn W. Garvey's Seattle Fire Department Centennial, 1889-1989, HistoryLink.org, Clarence Begley's 1916 History of Seattle from the Earliest Settlement to the Present Time, Volume 1, Murray Morgan's seminal 1951 Skid Road, James R. Warren's 1989 The Day Seattle Burned, Robin Natalie McNair Huff's 2016 Washington Disasters, Bill Spiedel's Sons of the Prophets, the Seattle Now and Then website, and the 1889 magazine. Thank you for listening to Episode 56, The Seattle Fire Revisited, Part 2. Episode 57 will be released next week. A special thanks goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast, and until next time, I'm your host, John C. Stay safe out there, everyone.
The bucket for days were running around, fire every bit. The fire marshal was gone on a trip to Frisco Bay. The mayor took control, the inferno had its way. Now just a smoldering pile, the bustling town was gone. The people, not the rats, were saved. Seattle would live on. Seattle fire in 1889. Cedar buildings burning one block at a time, all because some glue spilled and burst into flame. The rainy Emerald Town would never be the same. Fire, fire, there was fire everywhere. The bucket brigades were running around. Fire everywhere. Fire, fire, fire was everywhere. The bucket brigades were running around. Fire everywhere. Rudyard Kipling, a famous English poet, arrived by ship that very next day. Here's what he had to say. A horrible black smudge as though a hand had come down and rubbed the place smooth. I know now what being wiped out means.